From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez of Al Jazeera America, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Obama arrived in Cuba yesterday, the first president to visit since 1928, and more importantly, more remarkably, the first president to visit a country just 90 miles from the U.S. since communist Fidel Castro overthrew the U.S.-backed dictator, since President Kennedy's failed Bay of Pigs assault, since the Cuban Missile Crisis, those 13 days in 1962 when the United States and the Soviet Union skirted the edge of nuclear war. Now, in a new century, the U.S. president has toured Havana, will promote capitalism, meet with dissidents, and shake hands, again, with a Castro brother. This hour, On Point, President Obama in Cuba. You can join us on air or online. What do you want to see out of the Obama visit to Cuba? Should he have gone at all? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Havana, Cuba, is Alan Gomez, reporter for USA Today. Alan, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Ray.
Well, what's on the agenda today for the president?
The president has a pretty busy day today. He's going to start off laying a wreath at the Jose Marti Memorial. It's going to be an interesting scene because that's right in the middle of the Plaza of the Revolution, where Fidel Castro and Raul Castro for decades have given speeches to thousands and thousands of Cubans denouncing the United States. So that's just going to create an incredible image right there. After that, he's going to go into some working meetings with the Cuban government officials. He's also going to hold a summit later on where he's going to meet with some of the private entrepreneurs that have started here in Cuba in the last few years. And then at the end of the night, the entire family is going to a state dinner with Raul Castro. But to be sure, everybody assures us that he will not meet with Fidel, only Raul.
Has the Cuban government, has Cuban state media, lowered expectations for the trip and been kind of cagey about what was on the agenda when the two leaders meet?
Absolutely, they have. To be sure, this is everywhere here. You can't miss it. Usually, you know, if there's developments between the U.S. and Cuba, you won't even find it in state-run newspapers or on state television. But this trip has been absolutely broadcast around the country. Everybody here is very well aware of it, talking about it. They've been publishing schedules as to areas to avoid where the president's going to be during the time that he's here. And the big thing is, on Tuesday, the president is expected to deliver a speech from the Grand Theater in Old Havana that will be broadcast to the entire country, and the Cubans assure that it will be broadcast live and unedited. And that's the moment I think a lot of the Cubans down here are really looking forward to, because that's going to be their only opportunity to hear directly from the president. He's not going to be doing long drives around. There's not going to be sort of the papal procession that they're accustomed to down here. So that's going to be their big moment to hear directly from the president.
The president requested that he be heard throughout the island in this broadcast. He was very upfront before the trip about his intention to meet with dissidents. But lest anyone think that the Cuban government is loosening its grip on dissent on the island, what happened at the Ladies in White demonstration yesterday before the Obama's arrival?
It was really a remarkable scene. The Ladies in White basically is a group of dissidents here who have been marching every Sunday just about since 2003. What they usually do is they go to a church, they then march for a little bit where they're allowed to, and once they go outside of that area and start chanting and making a demonstration, they get rounded up and arrested. We were with them throughout the morning as they were doing this. Many of them thought that the Cuban government would lay off on that Sunday out of respect for the president's arrival, understanding what a touchy issue that has been in these negotiations. But sure enough, as soon as they walked outside of the area that they're allowed to, they were absolutely circled by hundreds of pro-Castro supporters. Police rounded them up very quickly and drove them all away in buses. The question now is how long they're going to be detained. Usually it's just for a few hours, but sometimes it's been for several days. And some of the people who were arrested were supposed to meet with the president tomorrow, so we're looking to see if they're released and allowed to see him.
Have there been explicit quid pro quos, calls for actions from the Cuban side on the part of the U.S. government before other bits of business, before other parts of the normalization of the relationship after 50 years of estrangement can proceed? Has the United States asked for and gotten anything specific?
Well, quite clearly on the question of human rights, they've gotten absolutely nothing. The Cuban government over the past few days has been very clear. Bruno Rodriguez, the foreign minister of Cuba, the way he put it was that the two countries have a different definition of human rights. So there has been absolutely no change there. And again, as evidenced by that roundup of more than 50 dissidents yesterday. What we do see is changes in sort of the business relationship and the diplomatic relationships. We know about the embassies now being open in Havana and Washington. U.S. air carriers are going to be heading down to the island probably by fall. We have direct mail service going down there now. And the U.S. has passed the Obama administration has created a bunch of new regulations to allow for U.S. investment and trade with Cuba. But what we have not seen so far is the Cubans embracing that just yet. So that's a lot of what we're waiting for. All these openings, all these possibilities for U.S. businesses to get into Cuba, we haven't seen the Cubans reciprocate yet. And so when there is some thought that there's been some back and forth here, but a lot of it has been on the U.S. side, and we're waiting for the Cubans to catch up.
Well, the president seems to be operating on the theory that whatever the Cubans do, the United States is going to operate in its own interest, with its own agenda, on its own time. The president visited the former interest section, now the United States Embassy in Havana, and spoke to embassy workers.
I know your workload is a lot heavier than it was, but I want you to know everything we've accomplished so far. More Americans coming to Cuba, more engagement with the Cuban people, civil society, faith groups, entrepreneurs, students, young people, more opportunities for the Cuban people to improve their lives. It's all happening because of you.
So, Alan, I guess the question is, with the United States proceeding in this way, can we say things have really changed, even if the Cuban government isn't playing along?
From December 2014, when they announced the reestablishment of diplomatic relations, that they were going to begin this process, I would say I haven't seen much change here in Cuba at all, and I think most Cubans would agree. But when you talk to the White House and when you understand what their strategy is, what they think is that nothing was going to change here if the embargo remained, if we continued isolating the country, but in their view, if they push, if they continue getting U.S. capital into the hands of Cuban citizens, if they continue assisting the new private entrepreneurs that are on the island, that will help them gain a level of economic independence from the Cuban government that will eventually allow them to then push the Cuban government to effect more change and to change its system better. In other words, 50 years of not engaging with them hasn't produced anything, so they think that even if the Cuban government isn't doing anything right now, that by helping those people gain that power, that will drive change faster than anything we can do on our own.
I have to tell you, on my reporting trips to Cuba in the last couple of years, I've found the Cuban people pretty well informed about what goes on in the United States, despite the presumed tight lid on media and information by the central government. Cynical, tough, and hopeful for better things. Here's Jose del Toro, who spoke to Reuters about his hopes for the coming relationship.
Cuba needs improvements, and I think this will come with these relations between Cuba and the United States. I don't know if it'll be 1 year or 2 years, but I think that Cuba deserves improvements.
So on the streets, in the cafes, in the parks, on their Sunday strolls, what do Cubans make of what's going on? Far from the government councils and the inside meetings of the Communist Party Central Committee, if you just chat up Cubans on the street, what do they have to say?
It's really amazing. This is a country that has incredibly limited internet access. I mean, I've seen some estimates down to something like 5%. So it's incredibly hard to get direct information from the outside world here. Yet you talk to Cubans on the street, they understand the Republican majority in Congress and how that's what's blocking the ability of the president to push for the end of the embargo. They understand the presidential candidates. They know exactly where Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz and Donald Trump and John Kasich, they know where they stand on the issues of the embargo and everything related to Cuba. This is a country that through talking with relatives in the U.S. or through these, in lieu of the Internet, what they have here is something called the package, where once a week somebody downloads a bunch of information through a pirated Internet connection, puts it all together and distributes it around the island on thumb drives and memory sticks. And through that, through talking with people in the U.S., through talking with visitors to the island, and more of those being Americans these days, they really have an understanding of what's going on in our political system. They understand how that relates to them and what it means for the future. So it's an incredibly informed population, despite the fact that they are so isolated.
Alan Gomez, it sounds like, along with any tempering of expectations from official sources, you're warning people not to expect too much too quickly out of these new developments.
Absolutely, because there's several components to it. When you look at the fact that the Cubans, yes, we created these openings, the president has kind of stuck his neck out for this, but the Cubans, they see this as such a monumental shift for them, that this government that's been in power for all these many years, that has created all these sort of circles of power within the island, now they're not going to just rush into something like this. For American businesses to expand into Cuba, it's really a tiny market. It's a pretty poor one. So there's not sort of these, it's not like opening into Brazil or something like that, where they're going to be scratching and clawing to get in.
Alan Gomez, reporter for USA Today. Sorry, I have to stop you there. Joining us today from Havana, Cuba. Thanks for taking the time. We're talking about the president's trip to Cuba. Do you want to go? Do you want to see a more open relationship? I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about President Obama's trip to Cuba. You can join the conversation. Should President Obama do more to protect Cuban dissidents? Can he do more? Do you see opportunities for American businesses in Cuba? Joining me now from Havana, Cuba is Pedro Freire. He's chair of international practice at the law firm Akerman in Miami, Florida. Professor of law at Columbia University. He's Cuban-American, left the island at 11. Pedro Freire, welcome to On Point.
Ray, it's a pleasure to be here.
And joining us from Washington is Michael Gonzalez, senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation, foreign policy advisor to Ted Cruz, a Cuban-American who left the country at the age of 12. Michael Gonzalez, welcome to On Point.
Hey, Ray, it's great to talk to you again. I'm here for Heritage, but it's great to talk to you again.
Pedro Freire, what's going on today? Are you part of the official delegation, someone who was invited to go down with the president? How should we understand your status in this trip?
Well, no, I'm not part of the 700-strong official government delegation, but I am invited tomorrow to witness in person the presidential address to the Cuban people at the National Theater. I am here as part of the U.S. Business Council Cuba Group, which is part of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. We have a group of about 11 people here as part of this.
As two people who left the island as young men and made your fortunes in the United States, it's funny how, even though you're coming at it from slightly different points of view, the question for you both might be the same. Did you ever think this day would come? Michael Gonzalez?
I wanted it to come with a free Cuba, not with what we're seeing right now. I'm actually pretty sad because I just see this as the evidence is overwhelming now. That the opening to the Castros has not been a success, has been a failure from any perspective you look at it. From the perspective of human rights, they've gotten much, much worse since December when President Obama announced his change in policy. From the perspective of doing business with Cuba, this is just enriching the Castro family directly. They control the economy. And from the point of view, that which should be paramount of U.S. national security, our national interest, I don't see how it helps America to perpetuate a communist dictatorship 90 miles from our border. We should have had a Polish or Czechoslovakian or Estonian transition. We're not going to have that now.
Though I must point out, since you mentioned Poland, we never broke diplomatic relations with Poland through decades of the Cold War and their membership in the Warsaw Pact, which was training to overwhelm and invade Western Europe.
Yeah, but we were very strenuous in pointing out every occasion that we had that they lived in a dictatorship, that we were on the side of the people. When Jaruzelski took the measures that he took in the 80s, President Reagan was very, very upfront. And so we always were very clear about the fact that we wanted democracy in Cuba. We wanted to have freedom. Sorry, in Poland. We wanted to have freedom in Poland. We have stopped saying that now with regards to Cuba. The president doesn't talk about democracy, doesn't really talk about human rights anymore.
Is that true, Pedro Ferreira? Does the president not make it clear he wants to see change in Cuba?
I think the president has made it very clear, and he will make it more clear tomorrow, that change is absolutely necessary here. He will be meeting with dissidents. Look, we don't live in a perfect world. And I kind of listen to what Michael is saying. You know, in the minds of many Cubans, many of us who left many years ago, the script was supposed to be different. But you know what? Reality imposed itself. My brother fought in the Bay of Pigs. He fought very bravely, and unfortunately, he was captured. It didn't succeed. My dad led the delegation with Jack Donovan that negotiated their release, and they came home. And then we built lives in America. And all this time, we've been worried about Cuba. And I started out a hardliner. And as time went by, it became very clear to me when I visited Cuba that the embargo was an abject failure. It was impotent. It was inefficient. It was inept. It wasn't accomplishing anything at all except imposing more misery on this wonderful land. And that the way forward is to empower Cubans, individual Cubans, to forge their own future. We can't impose it, but we can certainly help them have better lives and have them figure out what kind of future they want for themselves.
What about the rest of Michael's point, Pedro, that the U.S. has asked for little in return for this reopening and gotten even less as crackdowns and the jailing of dissidents and the harassment has continued, even as the United States has normalized relations, reopened post and telecommunications, made it easier for Cuba to access the international banking system? Is Michael right that there's been a quid with no pro quo?
Well, look, it's interesting when I hear somebody categorize as a failure a policy that has been in place for 15 months after a policy that was in place for 55 years that didn't accomplish anything at all except, have a negative impact on the population and have sort of the exact opposite effect of what we wanted. The United States is insisting on issues of human rights and opening, but more important than that, and we can't lose sight of this, is the impact on the everyday lives of Cubans. And when you come here and you look at the people on the street and you visit them, I just walked out 3 blocks away from my very nice hotel, and I went into the back street with my people. These are the people that I grew up with. These are the people that I know. I see them. I see what they go through. I see their poverty. But I talk to them, and I see them telling me that there is hope now, that this has to change, and that now, with the United States no longer an enemy, this will change. And that makes all the difference in the world.
Michael, how about that? That you can't make the real the enemy of the ideal and wait for your dreamed for, hoped for time of returning to a free Cuba, that this is a necessary precursor to that.
Hey, look, I'm a big fan of not making the good the enemy of the perfect, but there's nothing good here. And first of all, I recognize the sacrifice that Pedro's family made, but this is not about the past. This is about the present. This is about the future. I just got off the phone with Antonio Rodiles, one of the opposition leaders. He and his wife were beaten up yesterday for doing what you, Ray, what I do, and what Pedro does, which is speak our mind. They were beaten up, put in prison for 8 hours, separated. They tried to break his fingers. So this is what we – and I just go with the facts, right? Here's what's happened. In February, we had 1,141 political detentions. In January, 1,447. by the way, and that's just the repression, which yesterday was practiced on a major scale to send President Obama a message to tell him, we're giving you nothing, zero. With the business deals, it's not the Cubans who benefit, as Pedro knows. It's Gayesa. Gayesa is one of the largest holding companies in Latin America. It is controlled by Raul Castro's son-in-law, Luis Alberto Rodriguez Lopez Calleja. They're the people who are getting enriched. And Raul's son, who's the head of intelligence, is going to inherit power. And this is what is happening right now, and we're helping that happen.
Pedro Freire?
Well, look, again, you know, this isn't a zero-sum game, and this is a very subtle and complicated reality. So I will stipulate to the fact that Cuba has very serious human rights issues, and the United States needs to continue to push on that point. But I will also tell you that when you talk about enrichment, you know, it's not as simple as that, and you also see that on the street. You see the people dressing a little bit better. You talk to the taxi driver who has his own car, and he tells me, now I'm part of our co-op, and there's like five taxis working for me now because the Americans are here now. One of the things that you notice, and it's really touching, is the long-held friendship with America. The people here love Americans. Americans are generous. They're kind-hearted. They're big tippers. And all of that doesn't go unseen. And the other thing that is wonderful to behold is that we Cuban Americans, we were born here and now we're Americans. And we're back and we're being welcomed with open arms because the sense here is Cuban Americans have made their way in the biggest country in the world. There's a begrudging admiration, even though Marco Rubio is not exactly the most admired person in the world. There's a begrudging admiration that Cuban Americans have done well in our adopted land and that reflects very well for Cuba. So we have a role to play, and the role is to bring hope and to bring our know-how and our caring for this country and all the wonderful things that we've learned in America, including our love for freedom and our love for free enterprise, and share them with the Cuban people.
We're welcoming in spring with a snowstorm here in the Northeast, and we'll go first to Montreal, Canada, where Josh is calling. Josh, welcome.
Yes. Hola, Mr. Suarez. Just two or three points. First point, the historical visit, it seems to me in a historical context, similar to Nixon's and Kissinger's trip to China when they opened up, China to the Western capitalist world. Of course, the regime didn't change. But the second point, it's interesting to note that the Obama administration is, made overtures to open up towards some of its worst enemies, historically speaking. Iran, for instance, is enjoying a sort of a rapprochement and courtship with Washington, and now we see Cuba doing the same thing. There's a pas de deux or a waltz on both sides, and perhaps American business is driving this forward, but I don't think that American corporations will displace immediately business on the ground in Cuba because, as we know, the Europeans are already there, the Chinese are there, so it's a very tight market. And last point, your guest who made the comparison with the post-communist transition in Poland, I thought it was very interesting and salient. We will not see a regime change or a ideological shift just because of the opening of Cuba to U.S. interests. I think the Castro regime will stay in place. Thank
Josh, thanks for your call. Let me get reactions to what you had to say. First from Michael Gonzalez.
Well, that makes my point. We will not have a Polish transition because of what is taking place. The caller brought up China, which is a perfect analogy. I have visited China many times and lived in Hong Kong 8 years. I reported from there. At the beginning of the reforms, I too believed when I visited China in the 80s that political opening, political freedom was going to follow economic freedom. That did not happen. Plainly, that did not happen. If you speak up your mind in China, you get put in the gulag.
But wait, are you saying China hasn't changed in the last
China
several days?
China doesn't have a democracy. China doesn't have freedom of speech. China doesn't have freedom of association. It doesn't have freedom of religion. Okay, these are just facts. And if you win the Nobel Prize, they put you in prison, and they put your wife in prison for no reason. This is after 35 years of reforms. What do we expect to happen in Cuba? You know, Pedro says that my arguments are simple. My arguments, you know, I'm not going to go with anecdotes or with emotions. I'm just going to plainly, this business deals are not going to go to the Cuban people. They're not, because American companies cannot hire Cubans. It's only...
Yes, they can, as of last Gaesa, week.
No, Gaesa is in charge of the economy, and until you show me otherwise, I will not... This hasn't happened. In fact, if you look at the self-employed licenses, we had 10,000 fewer today than we had in 2014.
Pedro?
We need to understand something. We look at the alternative. What's the alternative? The United States has, in the past, had a, let's call it a checkered career in trying to impose regime change. Need I talk about Iraq and what a mess that became when we tried to impose democracy on the back of an M1 tank? We need to understand subtleties and nuances, and Cuba is a pretty unique place. One of the most unique things it has is it's 90 miles away from the United States. There are 2 million of us who were either born there or the children of people who were born there. And there is a flow of information, as we just heard. This is a country. For a country that has no internet penetration, I have never seen a better jungle telegraph to tell people exactly what's going on. And I will also tell you that there is a tremendous repressed expectation for change and the need for change. So when I look at the alternatives, you know, when I look at the alternative of freedom coming in, behind a 2,000-pound laser-guided bomb, or freedom coming in behind misery and suffering for a very long time, I think it's a fairly good bet that freedom can come in and prosperity can come in and the betterment of life can come in by opening up Cuba to the United States and having that flow of information and business and value creation do the job and let the Cuban people sort it out. They will. They've done it in the past. They'll do it again.
We're getting feedback for our conversation from social media. Claudia writes, "It's about time we lay this silly feud with Cuba to rest. We have friendly allies that are by far worse than Cuba when it comes to human rights." Doug writes, "I fully support the policy of engagement, but he needs to come back with something tangible in terms of loosening the Castro's grip on free expression." Gustavo writes, "So thrilled. These are my people who have been condemned to horrible poverty by a despotic and corrupt Castro government and by the selfishness and irrational hatred of Castro's generation of exiles in Miami, who are my family and my closest friends. It is long past time for our two countries to bridge their differences." Carter writes, 25 to 30 years from now, we will be looking back on this presidency as one that altered the political and social landscape of this country for the better. Iris writes, "One of the big challenges for the U.S. media will be to overcome their sense of wonder, avoid romanticizing Cuba, and accurately report the appalling conditions on the island. So far, I've noticed a pretty balanced reporting. I think there's a long way to go before the majority of Cubans will benefit from this opening. With that said, watching Air Force One landing in Havana yesterday was nothing short of astonishing. I hope the president's visit gives the Cuban people a sense of hope in their future." And Think in 15 writes, "The U.S. has relations, has had relationships, and even propped up military dictatorships around the world for decades. Cuba shouldn't be singled out as if they were the U.S.'s biggest enemy. Change for the better in Cuba will come with opening up a relationship." I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simplest way to create a beautiful website. Whether your passion is bold, unconventional, or just plain crazy, you should share it with the world in an unforgettable way. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint. And enter offer code ONPOINT at checkout to get 10% off your first purchase.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about President Obama's historic trip to Cuba. You can join the conversation. What next for Cuba and the United States should the embargo end? How will U.S. capitalism influence the communist island? Joining me from Havana is Pedro Ferra, chairman of international practice at the law firm Akerman in Miami, Florida, professor of law at Columbia University. And joining me from Washington is Michael Gonzalez, and he's been a foreign policy advisor to Ted Cruz, who had something to say about whether this should proceed when he spoke on Cuba last month.
My family has seen firsthand the evil and the oppression in Cuba, and we need to have a president that stands up to our enemies.
And here's President Obama in February announcing his trip to Cuba. He expressed to Americans his high hopes and expectations for the trip and the future of Cuban-American relations.
I believe that the best way to advance American interests and values, and the best way to help the Cuban people improve their lives, is through engagement, by normalizing relations between our governments and increasing contacts between our peoples.
Pedro Ferra and Michael Gonzalez are still with me. We go next to Culebra, Puerto Rico, where Jim is calling. And Jim, I didn't know anybody was actually on Culebra. I thought most of it was a nature reserve.
Not as about 2,500 people that live here year-round. And we get a fair amount of tourists, but we like to tell everybody there's a lot of mosquito and a lot of crime, so nobody comes. Anyway, reference to Cuba, I go back with this a little bit. I was in Special Forces in the 60s, and I followed Cuba as much as I could from back then till now. Part of the problem is we don't have a lot of the information that our intelligence services have and the FBI has. Okay, so we are commenting on this without knowing what has gone on and what still goes on.
Like what kind of things are you talking about, Jim?
I'll get to that in a second. Just give me a second, right? The only reason why the Castro brothers and the regime in charge is even considered this and opened up a little bit is because they are broke. The Russians cannot give them any money anymore. They're broke. And Venezuela and Hugo Chavez are out of the picture. Well, he's out of the picture, but they can't get any money from them because they're broke, because the price of oil has gone down to nothing, and these socialistic societies have failed disastrously, okay? So, you know, that's the reason. I mean, you know, you always got to look at what's wrong with this picture. I was also a detective for a lot of years. What's wrong with this picture? All right, so what's wrong with this picture is they need us just because of the money.
Let me put that to my guests, Pedro and Michael. Pedro, what do you make of that point, that this was an act of desperation, finally? The jig was up for the Castro brothers.
I wouldn't qualify it as desperation. I think Jim makes one point that we need to keep in consideration. I do think, I mean, let's be realistic here. Cuba went through an extremely difficult period when the Soviet bloc collapsed. They went through the so-called special period where things were really, really miserable here. They made it through that. And no question but that the people in power here need to be thinking about the future of Venezuela, which fuels a substantial amount of revenue for the Cuban government. But even if that were to go away, there is no reason to believe that that would be this sort of cataclysmic event. But I think I'd go one step beyond. I think we need to look at the best interest of the United States. And it is in the best interest of the United States that the way that Cuba transitions and moves forward is not through a collapse. I mean, we've been there before. We've seen countries collapse. I think I don't need to name names. We've driven countries to collapse. And what has ensued from that is not good for the country or for the United States. So what makes sense here, particularly because of how close we are and because of these family ties that we've been talking about, is to empower the Cuban people and to make their lives better and to lead by example rather than speak.
Michael Gonzalez?
You talked, Ray, and your caller talked about what will happen in Cuba with capitalism. We know what will happen. It's called corporatism. Mussolini had it. China has it today. This cannot be repeated often enough to Pedro. Pedro, the model is there. China is not a democracy today, and they introduced reforms in 78. Vietnam is not a democracy today. This is what lays ahead. And that is why I worry about U.S. national interest, worry about the fact that power is now going to be transferred to Alejandro Castro-Espín, Mariela Castro-Espín, and Luis Alberto Rodriguez, who controls the economy. Let's stop talking about Raul and Fidel. They're in their 80s. They're going to die soon. Let's start talking about Alejandro, the son, the colonel in the army, who is the head of intelligence. He will inherit power. Luis Alberto controls GAESA, which controls the economy, and Mariela is in the National Assembly. This could not be in our best national interest to make sure that we perpetuate a corporatist regime 90 miles from our border that does not like the U.S., that is controlled by one-party rule, and that is enriching itself.
Let's go back to the phones. Justine is calling us from New Milford, Connecticut. Justine, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray. I just came back from a people-to-people visit in Cuba a couple of days ago. I happen to be a social scientist as well. And I completely understand that the democratic free expression of people there is not. I'm not Pollyanna in any of this. But I had a very different experience with people that we met. And we could talk to freely. We could ask them about anything. The first thing you see when you've come into the airport there is especially for Americans, there are no advertisements for any products. All you see are beautiful pictures of this country that says Cuba Auténtico. I've been in the Soviet Union under the Soviet time. People were not downtrodden in the way they are. You can see the poverty of people. You can see that they have have lots of ingenuity about making things given the special period which they're coming out of now. They're poor. The embargo needs to stop for sure. This is not helping at all. But the point I want to make is that I experienced people very sophisticated being able to speak about socialism much more sophisticatedly than people here who call Bernie Sanders a communist. They could speak in the language of conflict, of dialectic, of tension. They would say, on the one hand, the economy is poor. We need to do something better. On the other hand, we do not want what the United States has in terms of so many people that don't have health care. We value the fact that we have 100% literacy, different even from other Latin American countries. We value that we have health care. We value that we have free education from the beginning to university. They don't want to lose that, and that's what they're afraid of. They have the experience of Fulgencio Batista, how nobody paid taxes to the government. There's a reason why there was a revolution, etc. But they're very wary about losing the socialistic collective view that you see among people. They help one another out. You see, people make their own happiness. I mean, that was amazing. People didn't need to buy stuff like in this country purely as a way to make themselves happy. You saw so much music, so much dancing. We went to lots of art things. We went to the home of Pedro Oliva, who is a dissident in his art, but very sophisticatedly so. He draws paintings of Castro in very provocative ways.
Justine, let me put your points to Pedro Freira, who is in Havana right now. And, you know, when you talk to people, Pedro, about their lives in Cuba and what the future looks like, I think Americans get the idea that if the current state of affairs went away, Cubans would be ready to embrace an entirely new way of life and get rid of what they consider parts of the revolution. I came away from my last visit not really sure that was the case. What do you make of that?
I tend to agree, and I think the name of the game here is nuance and subtlety. You can't look at a country and just talk about three people ruling, quote-unquote, the country. It's not that simple. This is a complicated society, and it's very funny what the last speaker said, that people on the street will talk to you very openly about criticizing the government, and, they do that. Clearly, that doesn't mean that there's freedom of expression at the level of political organization. There is not. But there is, at very many levels, this pride. First of all, it's a tremendously nationalistic society, tremendously proud of who they are. Second, there is a sense of gratitude that this country has evolved in a way where there is universal education. Literacy rate is at 99.7%. And even though they lack medicines because the socialist economy simply does not work,
the healthcare delivery system is really good, and people want that, and they want to continue with that. So this isn't a black or white. Again, this isn't a zero-sum game. This isn't switch off one system, switch on the other, and, you know, magical, wonderful things will happen if we just make misery so unbearable that the people will rise up with torches. It doesn't work that way.
Michael Gonzalez?
Nobody's talking about that. The reason why Cuba failed and it's poor today and people have misery is because communism fails. It failed in Germany. It failed in Asia. It failed everywhere. Why would it succeed in the Caribbean? So this is not about hatred. And this is about the people there today. I'm sorry, the last caller talked about Cubans liking to sing and dance. The Cuban people are oppressed. They're oppressed. They have the same right as everyone else in the world does to practice their religion, to practice freedom of speech, to practice freedom of association, to have labor unions. They have been denied these rights. As to literacy, as Pedro well knows, because I'm sure he knows, he studied this, in the 1950s, Cuba had the second highest literacy rate or the first highest literacy rate in Latin America. All its cultural indicators were really, really good. The United Nations statistics are there. So it's not like Cuba was a failure. Cuba was a wealthy place. My grandparents immigrated from Europe to Cuba. To think of a European going to Cuba today is laughable. Cuba failed because of communism.
Here's a comment from our website, onpointradio.org. Ken writes, the best way to put an end to Cuba's oppressive government is peaceful trade. Soon we will have a human wave of American tourists invading Cuban beaches, yelling USA, USA, and waving visa cards. The commies won't have a chance. The Measure of a Man writes, those critical of Obama's foray into Cuba are simply throwing BS at a fan. We have better relations with other countries that are much worse than Cuba, like China, for instance, and there is the sound of crickets from these same people. The arguments for opening relations with China was that if we have trade and relations, human rights would follow. Merlin, 1935, writes, does anyone know the reason Raul Castro did not receive President Obama at the airport? Apart from the fact that this is standard diplomatic courtesy, the visit is also a historic event deserving full operation of the Cuban state. Pedro, you're in Havana. That was something that was much remarked upon on this side of the Straits of Florida, that he was not met by high-ranking members.
Well, and I'll tell you, I mean, Donald Trump, in his usual brilliance, had the solution to the problem. He called it amateur hour, and being the wonderful master of protocol and subtlety that he is, he said that his approach would have been to get on Air Force One, turn around, and leave. And that's, you know, that's just the epitome of silliness, not to call it anything else. Standard protocol is that the Minister of Foreign Relations will meet the head of state. And yes, was there a subtle message there, you know, kind of a little dig at the United States saying, well, for the Pope, we had the big guy here, but for you, we're not. Yeah, so what? You know, we're grown-ups here. We're trying to push a much more important issue here. So, you know, they sent the foreign minister, and there was one bouquet of flowers instead of four. Get on with it.
Michael Gonzalez, we're coming to the end of our time, but you know, the argument over whether to reopen relations is over. They are open. There's a Cuban embassy and a Cuban flag flying over 16th Street in Washington, D.C. The argument over opening postal relations, ferry service, banking, these are all over. For your side of the argument, what's the best that can happen now? What can you push for realistically from this point where we are at in real life on?
Actually, no, I disagree with that, Ray, with respect. I don't think everything is irreversible. I think the next president who comes in will be able to reverse a lot of these mistakes, and they are mistakes. I mean, Pedro is willing to overlook quite a lot. He says, get over it. No, this is not just about a snub. This is not just about the fact that that Obama said to Yahoo in December, I will only go if Castro, you know, relaxes his grip on the people. That did not happen. Obama still went. This is about the fact that the tensions are at an all-time high. These are facts that people like Pedro, who support this policy, cannot wave away and say, you know, get over it. No. He and I live in freedom. He and I have been successes in the United States. What about the people we left behind? What about the people who are dragged and put in prison with rats? These are people who are speaking their minds. They are the conscience of Cuba. We should be on their side, not on the side of the tormentors.
So you're saying put your hopes on a new presidency that begins in January 2017?
I'm saying that, look, I am very happy to be proven wrong. If Obama tomorrow, President Obama, my president, speaks to the Cuban people and says something like, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, or like Pope John Paul II said to the Polish people, be not afraid. If he says something that is transformational to the Cuban people and not continue to talk about a colonial relationship, which is what he has done, he pretty much echoes the Cuban propaganda's rhetoric. If he doesn't do that, I'll be very happy if he's on the side of the people.
Michael Gonzalez is a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation and a foreign policy advisor to Ted Cruz. Great to have you with us, Michael.
Thank you.
Pedro Frere from Havana, Cuba, the chair of international practice at the law firm Akerman in Miami, Florida, professor of law at Columbia University. Great to talk to you again, Pedro.
Thank you, Ray. It's been a pleasure.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, the U.S. is now calling the Islamic State's atrocities genocide. Will that change U.S. response? I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.